It's the BBG, not the BBC.
You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah. Well, we know how bad the broadcast media has been around coronavirus coverage, but the print media here in the UK and in Ireland hasn't been much better either. So I've invited the brilliant journalist Kevin Myers back to the programme. Kevin is a hugely accomplished author. I mentioned journalist and broadcaster. I'll be getting his take on the lockdown, but the issues around it as well. Obviously, civil liberties, etc., etc. Kevin Myers this hour, and in the second hour of the programme, I will be taking your calls, as usual, via Skype or via landline, and the details have been pinned to the top of my Twitter feed, and they've been pinned on Facebook as well. All right. Scorchio tremendo. El Scorchio tremendo here in Salford. Tis only gorgeous, I tells you. Beautiful weather. Hey, Camir, did you hear the news, did you? Figures have been released this afternoon confirming what we already knew, and that is that the coronavirus is basically no more than a bit of a flu or a bit of a heavy cold. It gets worse than that, though. 7% of the UK population has already had the coronavirus, and of those, only 1 in 5 will have shown any symptoms at all. And again, of that 1 in 5 that would have shown any symptoms at all, again, you're diluting and diluting all the time, a tiny, tiny, tiny minority, 0.0002% or whatever it is, would be so ill that they would require hospital attention. And of those who do, it's a tinier fraction again of those who would actually die. Did you hear that, Tom?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
Well, I can't repeat all of that, Tom. But what I can say is, you have more chance of being killed by a falling piano with the green goblin sitting at it playing it while he's being pursued by Spider-Man, of actually getting seriously ill than you... Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I should have thought that one out. You've got more chance of being killed by a piano than you have of becoming seriously ill from coronavirus. And yet here we are. Welcome to Thursday's programme. It's the 28th of May. You know, and the truth will set you free, will it? I don't know. People are oblivious to it, I think. It's going to be even hotter this coming weekend, tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday. I'm glad today is the final show of the week, much as I love talking to you, because it's warm. Now, the Jeffrey Epstein documentary, entitled Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich, was released by Netflix yesterday. It's in 4 parts. I've watched 2.5 parts myself. It's basically stories from survivors, people who were abused by Epstein. It's asking the question, how could Epstein carry on doing what he was doing on the scale he was doing it and get away with it? How did he get away with it? Here's a couple of interesting clips. Steve Scully worked on Epstein's Island for 5 or 6 years. He was an IT guy. This is from the documentary Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich. Steve Scully, former employee.
I started working on the island in 1999 and worked until either the end of 2005 or the start of 2006. I was there for maintenance on Jeffrey Epstein's telecommunications and data equipment. He wanted a private cellular network. Privacy was very important to Jeffrey Epstein. I was on the island probably 100 times. I was ultimately in every single building that existed on the island at that time. And I would say every other month I would see guests on the island, and the guests almost always included young girls. One time I went to the grotto, the little beach as it was coined, and when I walked down, there was a gentleman who was not Jeffrey and three girls. The three girls were topless. The gentleman was nude. I left immediately. Sometimes there were other people on the island that were important people. I saw Alan Dershowitz on the island. It was more of a business meeting another time. I saw Bill Clinton sitting with Jeffrey on the living room porch area, which was Jeffrey's favorite spot. I saw no other guests there at that time at all. I just said, hey, wow. Jeffrey sitting with Bill Clinton.
Yes, of course, Bill Clinton, he of I did not have sex. That guy denies ever being on the island. What about Prince Andrew, Steve Scully?
It's probably around 2004. I saw Prince Andrew. He was at the pool. He was with, at that time, an unknown girl to me. She was young. She didn't have any top on. They were engaged in foreplay. He was grabbing her and grinding against her. You know, you tell yourself that you didn't know for sure and you never really saw anything. But that's just all rationalization. Jeffrey Epstein, he was a guy that concealed his deviance very well, but he didn't conceal it that well.
It would appear so. Now, you've heard the name Virginia Roberts Giuffre a lot, right, in recent months. Well, in the last year or thereabouts, and the Prince Andrew claims and all of that. She, of course, is a big part of the documentary. She says that Epstein boasted that he had been sent a present of very young girls from France. Here's the claim.
It was Jeffrey's birthday one year. I don't remember what year it was, but I would say it's a good year into our relationship or knowing each other. And he was laughing about the fact that his friend sent him three 12-year-old girls that he had purchased from their parents.
He was laughing about the fact that his friend had sent him three very young girls that had been purchased from their parents. Now, you're going to hear a guy called Brad Edwards. It's the last clip we've got because it's a bit cheeky to be giving you the clips. You can watch it on Netflix if you have subscribed. Brad Edwards is a lawyer who represents some of Epstein's victims. And he got to depose Jeffrey Epstein back around 2009, 2010. And while deposing Epstein, well, he certainly brought up the claim that 12-year-old girls had been flown across the Atlantic to be destroyed by Epstein and his pals. Here's the exchange from the deposition.
On one of defendant Epstein's birthdays, a friend of defendant Epstein sent him three 12-year-old girls from France who spoke no English for defendant to sexually exploit and abuse. After doing so, they were sent back to France the next day. Isn't that true?
Once again, I'm going to move to strike. Irrelevant, argumentative, harassing.
I would like to answer that question. I really would. However, today, my attorneys have told me I have to assert my Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, and 14th Amendment rights of the U.S. Constitution.
You're invoking your Fifth Amendment rights to each of these questions because you know that your answers will incriminate you and you feel that it will result in you being prosecuted for these crimes. Isn't that right?
Objection, argumentative, harassing, and calls for a legal conclusion.
No, in fact, the Supreme Court recently said that the Fifth Amendment right is there to protect the innocent. So that's the way I'd like to answer that.
It's well worth a look, I've got to say. Going to watch the final episode later on. Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich, Netflix. Check it out. That's interesting. It's not interesting. It's repulsive, of course. But until we got to the revelations about the 12-year-olds, it looked like they were focusing primarily on high school girls, which is dreadful and disgusting and repulsive as well, of course. But Epstein was into lots of things that I'm not sure the documentary is getting into, but it's worth a look anyway. Hey, listen, I whinge on about the media not informing people and how it hasn't done that for a very long time. And I think we've seen, it could be argued, there's that lovely phrase, it could be argued that the collective media is actively working to get me and you to comply with the lockdown. Now, that won't come as any news to you, because you're not stupid. You know this, right? It's not challenging it, it's going along with it. And we've seen some amazing spectacles in the last 5, 6, 7 weeks where news journalists, some of them very proud news journalists, who brag about being very good journalists, are not only not asking any questions, but they're working to make your life more bearable in lockdown, getting you to comply. So this, for somebody who studies the media and how the media operates and how it has evolved, it's a thing of real fascination for me. It might be boring you to death at this stage, and if so, I won't carry on with much more of it. But it's an extraordinary thing. So we've joked about Kay Burley, the Sky News presenter who's done more live television than any other person in the UK anyway. And every week she's had virtual tours of beauty spots around the world. This week it was the Acropolis. Now, I didn't and I won't subject you to the virtual tour of the Acropolis. But if that's not bad enough, have a listen to this. Kay Burley goes live at 7 o'clock every morning. And it's a big moment for any presenter. Prime time. You know, you're under the gun. You've got loads of competition. ITV. You want to be bringing the news, hard news to people. Here's Kay Burley's opening this morning at 7.
Hi, everyone. Very good morning. 7 o'clock. You're watching Kay Burley at breakfast this Thursday morning. An important moment in our battle against the coronavirus. With the launch of the test and trace system, the government hopes will keep the virus under control as lockdown restrictions are eased. We're about to learn whether that system is up to the challenge and, crucially, whether the political scandal surrounding Dominic Cummings has done lasting damage.
What was that? What did she say there? I couldn't make head or tail of this morning.
We're about to learn whether that system is up to the challenge and, crucially, whether the political scandal surrounding Dominic Cummings has done lasting damage the government's ability to ask people to perform their civic duty.
Right, that's story one, right? 7 o'clock. What's coming after that?
The health secretary joins us in just a moment. Also this morning, the travel industry calls for 14-day quarantines to be abandoned. And Mob Kitchen brings you another great lockdown recipe idea that won't cost the earth. It's Thursday, the 28th of May.
Right, so we've got Matt Hancock track and trace, we've got the travel industry quarantine, and we've got a lockdown recipe for you.
What kind of fuckery is this?
With Mob Kitchen is going to do some cooking on a news programme. How did she get on with the cooking? Let's find out.
Hello again, you're watching Kay Burley at breakfast. Mob Kitchen are back in the house. They're going to teach us how to, well, I don't know what they're going to teach us to do. Let's find out. Standing by, here's Ben. There he is. Hey, Ben, how you doing?
Good, Kay. How you doing?
Yeah, great. Show me.
Show me. I'm doing great. Show me. Keep your hair on, Kay. Anyway, he shows her a recipe, potatoes and stuff. He rambles on while he cooks some sautéed potatoes. And then Kay jumps in, doesn't she?
I mean, you're massive. Mob Kitchen's...
He's massive.
He's massive on social media. What you're trying to do is create recipes that are cheap and people can throw together during lockdown, yeah?
Exactly. So all of our recipes are super cheap, super affordable. I started the platform about 3.5 years ago with the premise that every recipe feeds 4 people for under a tenner.
Yeah, so
I mean, you're massive.
Yeah, he's massive. The point of it is to give you a recipe to keep you occupied in lockdown. It's an extraordinary thing, this, isn't it, that we're witnessing? We're not going to challenge the necessity of the lockdown or facilitate any discussion on what it's going to do to people. No, we're going to make sure that you're nice and comfortable in your own houses. And we're going to take news programmes and turn them into magazine programmes. And we're going to do it, well, we're going to do it under your noses. It gets worse, not with Kay, but with Sky News today. Speaking of the lockdown, Kay will break it for a good plate of food.
Lovely little summer salad.
Don't you touch it until I'm coming round for that. Don't you touch it. It's good to see you. Thanks a lot.
She's coming round.
I'll save it for you, Kay.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. It's amazing, isn't it? It looks fantastic. Hopefully we'll be able to convince him to come again next week. Let's see. Can't promise, but...
Okay, promise.
A bit like the Prime Minister yesterday with the liaison committee, but I'll do my best.
She'll do her best for us. So that's what you have now, a programme broken up with virtual travel and cookery to help you cope with the lockdown. And it's not just Kay Burley. Her afternoon colleague, Sarah Jane Mee, was at the same thing. I swear on all that is sacred to me, this afternoon, on the Sarah Jane Mee news show on Sky News, she spent it speaking to farmers in Barnsley who are streaming sheep shearing and live lambing because it soothes us in the lockdown. And after that, she had an urban poet on, a poet who has written about the lockdown. And then she announced, I swear to God, this is in sequence. She announced that Sky is part of a campaign to give NHS workers, well, a free holiday.
My next guest this afternoon, a part of our hashtag treat our NHS campaign, which
our hashtag treat the NHS campaign, she said.
My next guest this afternoon, a part of our hashtag treat our NHS campaign, which has seen holiday homeowners and hoteliers come together to offer NHS staff a well-deserved holiday when this is all over. Well, so far, more than 1,000 getaways have been donated.
Yeah, 1,000 getaways have been donated because of our campaign to get people to give holidays for our NHS workers who are so busy doing the Can-Can and the Charleston and performing the score to HMS Pinafore using mops and buckets as swords and cutlasses, that when all that's done, we better give him a holiday. So this is conditioning, you see. The NHS is a sacred thing. Ask not what your NHS can do for you, but what you can do for your NHS. You might think, I would say, it's ask not what your NHS can do for you, but what have you done for your NHS lately? What have you done for your NHS lately? What have you done for your NHS? Have you clapped them? Have you got the fuck out of the way of somebody wearing a uniform queuing for your groceries at your local supermarket? Have you? It's conditioning this. Despite the fact that your taxes pay for the NHS, despite the fact that they are not fucking heroes, they are employees doing a job they were trained to do. That's what they are. Tonight, apparently, we'll see the last clap for the NHS at 8 o'clock here in the UK. It's the 10th week of it. If you've clapped at once, even once, get the fuck off of my live stream. Private Pile, get the fuck off of my obstacle. Get off of my live stream. If you went out one Thursday, get out of here. Get out. You'll never learn. So just after Sarah Jane Mee on Sky talked about let's get free holidays for the NHS dancers and singers and choral societies, they promoted the Dermot Murnaghan show, which will take place next week. And this is really sick. Listen to this.
Coronavirus has changed everything. So what will our new world be like once the pandemic is over? Well, from Monday, I'll be joined by some of the biggest names from the worlds of culture, economics, politics, science and technology to find out how all our lives are going to change. And you can join in too to be part of our virtual audience. Email after the pandemic.
Virtual audience.
Pandemic at sky.uk or go to skynews.com. That's After the Pandemic, Our New World, live on Sky News at 8 p.m. from Monday.
From Monday! You see? So the question of whether life does in fact need to change has gone out of the window. It will change, your news media is telling you. And we will get experts on, or useless idiots as we like to call them, to tell you how your life will change. Even though the truth is hiding in plain sight. The virus is harmless to 99.9999999% of every man, woman and child on planet Earth. Your life is going to change, whether you like it or not. And we're going to show you how it's going to change, beginning with a series of special programs next week. Virtue signaling will become part of everybody's lives. It will. We are being conditioned. We are being taken to a place emotionally, psychologically, where when we get to the destination they want us to reach, we will be compelled to play along with the virtue signaling Olympics that we see, where you've got to be filming yourself doing something nice and putting it on Instagram or TikTok or Twitter or whatever to show how good you are. And that's all, of course, going to be part of our social crediting future. This is insane. And thank God we've got a journalist to talk to this, to talk to about this in 3 minutes' time. Kevin Myers will be live on the line from God's country. Great journalist, broadcaster, of course, and author. While we get Kevin on, here's Moz. The Great Moz with Interesting Drug on The Richie Allen Show, which is live from Salford. It's Scorchio Tremendo. Back with Kevin Myers in 2.5 minutes. Right, it is now 25 and a half minutes past the hour. Live from Salford in Greater Manchester, your Richie Allen Radio Show on Fab Radio 2 here in the great city. We're on the TuneIn app, of course, as well. iTunes, Spotify and all of that nonsense. I can't wait to chat with Kevin. He's standing by just before we welcome him back to the programme. It's a real treat today. UK unemployment is expected to more than double this summer after the number of people claiming unemployment benefits rose by 70% last month, the most since records began. Economists, former Bank of England governors, are telling us that millions of jobs are at risk, not just here, not just in Ireland where Kevin is, but everywhere. The current Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, said last week that Britain faces a severe recession, the likes of which we haven't seen. It's dire. Where is the media? Well, we just had a good giggle at the broadcast media. But what about the print media? Where is it? Isn't it supposed to rigorously and vigorously hold to account those who made the decision to place the nation under house arrest and destroy the economy? Something which scientists concede will cause far more death and misery in the long term than any virus at all. What about the implications for basic human rights and civil liberties? Is anybody asking these questions? My guest is a hugely accomplished author, journalist and broadcaster. He would be asking these questions if he was still writing for the National Press. That's another story. Let's welcome back to the programme Kevin Myers. Kevin, I'm thrilled you're back on. How are you?
Well, it's thrilled to be with you. I'm enjoying the sunshine in County Kildare in Ireland and sharing your shock and horror at the global stupidity which is destroying the economic prospects for an entire generation. This has to be the greatest collective calamity in my lifetime to assail the world. And you have already adverted to the fact that the media are not doing their job. I'm never sure it's singular or plural, the word media. But there we are. The job is not being done. The questions are not being asked. What you've got is cowardice and conformism and this other element to informism, where people are informing on their neighbours. And this is kind of reminiscent of the days of any draconian regime where you ring up somebody, you ring the authorities because of somebody you don't like doing something you disapprove of, and you get put on the blacklist. You can call it Gestapo, call it Stasi, call it Vichy France, but it's a comparable emotion. You inform on people for doing things that are not doing any harm to anybody. I mean, just one small example. Every one of your listeners will know examples of their own, but a friend of mine has a house on a lake in the centre of Ireland. And he went fishing from his boat 100 yards offshore, and a police patrol car vessel came alongside him and told him to go ashore because he was violating the rules. We all know of stories like this. Talk about social distancing. He wasn't within 200 yards of anyone. He wasn't within a mile of anyone, but he was told to go back to his house. Now, I don't know who reported Dominic Cummings. I don't know who reported the paratroop colonel who's probably lost his job and who was having drinks with some fellow soldiers. But that's a very, very disagreeable sensation that people can phone or ring you, inform on you for doing things that are perfectly normal and natural. What we've done is, this is something that hasn't happened since an Aztec society used to sacrifice their young people to ensure that next year's crops were good. What we've done is sacrifice the educational prospects of every single child and every single undergraduate in these islands and in Europe to save the health of people of my age. And that is simply wicked. It is completely wicked. And the most extraordinary thing is how the media have aligned themselves with this extraordinarily dangerous and destructive project, because no good can come of it. Yet the media that lies, for example, the Irish Times, 2 weeks ago had a special supplement on the deaths that had been caused by the coronavirus, and one was a sporting hero who had died. Well, he had been a sporting hero in the 1950s. Now, this is just stupid. One of the dead of the coronavirus that we were all meant to mourn is a man who was aged 100. And meanwhile, 17, 18-year-olds are not doing their A-levels or their leaving certificate or any of the final results. And universities all over these islands and all over Europe are not processing students. And the information is already coming through from Norway and Iceland that we've got it wrong, that things were not as bad as were being projected, and that, in fact, that the shutdown is doing far more damage, as you introduced and as you said in your introduction, is doing far more damage than the virus could ever do.
Before we come back to how people have become snitches and snoops, which is hugely important, before we come back to that, we'll talk about plenty of things. You say it's a wicked thing to do, protecting people of your age. They would say, I would imagine, we get accused, they would say, I'm talking about government departments, they would say, we get accused of ageism all the time. We get accused of abandoning the elderly. Here, what we've tried to do is to do all that we could to protect the most vulnerable, those who are most likely to become ill from it, and now we're getting hammered for it. They would say lockdown...
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that would come up. This is the governor state at its most demented and deranged. Old people, and that includes me, have to look after our own health. We have to be held responsible and accountable for whatever happens to us, and we should obviously take precautions. But we know from Iceland and we know from other places that the conductivity of the disease amongst young people is almost non-existent. In Iceland, it appears to be completely non-existent, that a large number of children contracted the virus and exhibited no symptoms whatever, and there was zero transmission from children to adults in Iceland.
Yeah.
So, okay, so what do you do? Do you take the risk of shortening the lives of people of my age and older? Yes, absolutely you do. You do not throw on the funeral pyre the future of young people, but they are already stressed as it is. It's bad enough being 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. We've all been through those days, and they're terrible days. To add this extra burden is quite insupportable. And one of the most extraordinary things, and I actually can't speak here for the events in Britain, but in Ireland, the teachers' unions have essentially said that, no, we will not arrange the exams to take place in the where the summer holidays will be, because they're insisting on retaining their summer holidays. And what we've done is we've put the entire population into a kind of permanent freeze of the welfare state and destroying the basic economy underneath the welfare state. So people have expectations and people are going to have money from the welfare state that are entirely unsupportable. It will not be possible for Western societies to pay back the debts that are being incurred to protect people in their 70s and 80s and 90s. Now, we all know how insane this is, but the worst thing is, even if I am mistaken, is that voices like mine are not being heard at all in the Irish media. And in Britain, it's just Peter Hitchens, Lionel Shriver, and Douglas Murray are raising the voices of dissent. Now, all of us might be wrong on this, but the only way to be proved wrong is to have an open debate in which there is an exchange of information without the sneering and the bullying and the cajoling and the name-calling, which now is a standard feature of any debate in life anywhere, in not just in Europe, but in the United States of America and everywhere. The first thing you do is reduce somebody to a caricature and then destroy the caricature. And it's impossible for any state policy to be created in those circumstances.
It's bad enough that voices like yourself, like yours, have been marginalised, save for the one or two that you mentioned. But what's even worse, again, if I can say this, and I have worked at every level of the media, local, national, independent, you've got something even more sinister going on, because scientific voices, equally as credible as the ones who demanded the lockdown, are being kept off the airways. I'm thinking of guys like Carl Heenahan, or Hennigan as they call him here, at Oxford University, a very senior, evidentiary-based medicinal professor. I've said that all wrong. Great guy. He's saying the lockdown is crazy, shouldn't have happened to begin with, but they're keeping them off the air, Kevin.
Of course they are. I mean, the whole thing about the global warming was that you only heard one side of the argument.
Yeah.
A 14-year-old Swede who knows nothing about the environment, nothing about science, was elevated into sainthood.
Yeah.
I mean, this is simple organizational madness. She addressed the United Nations as if she had anything to say to the world. She's a 14-year-old Swede. She knows nothing about the world. She knows nothing about the atmosphere. She knows nothing about the weather. She knows nothing about meteorology. She knows nothing about the climate. She knows nothing whatever. Yet she was elevated like the saints of Fatima and Lourdes in the 19th century and in the early 20th century. When you elevate a teenage girl into a position of sanctity, you know something seriously is going wrong. And Fatima and Lourdes and the Swedish girl who's Greta Thunberg, this is all a comparable phenomenon, where you elevate a virgin and take her word as being more important than the words of serious scientists. Now, it's not surprising, looking at in retrospect, that we have committed economic suicide in Western Europe if we were so gullible as to elevate this girl of last year into a position of sanctity, where her word was more important than any of the scientists of the kind you're talking about with whom she contradicted. She was able to silence people merely because she was surrounded by the aura of sanctity. Now, if you don't discuss major issues seriously, then you are going to drive yourself into calamity. And this is what's happening. And I haven't heard any economic explanation of how we're going to get out of this. Why are soldiers not being allowed to drink together if they are, as soldiers, meant to train together? Aren't police forces not training together and not cooperating together? The fact is, organizations and states survive because people cooperate with one another. They have to take precautions to ensure that their health is being protected. But you don't destroy careers, and you don't have the kind of nonsense and hysteria that we've seen over the recent weeks in Britain for such trivial causes. Now, there is a Scottish minister, Health Minister Catherine Calderwood, who was twice warned about going to her holiday home, and she's a foolish woman. She went, she had been warned and she ignored the warning. But I think perhaps she was looking for trouble. For the most part, people are obeying the law because they're scared of breaking from the consensus. Now, I haven't followed Dominic Cummings' thing very closely. It's caused enormous joy in Ireland because Ireland's going through an intensely disagreeable period of Anglophobia, and this just seems to me, to them, many Irish people, evidence of hypocrisy. I've read the Cummings affair. I think he was doing what any father would have done in the circumstances. And if he wasn't breaking a law, he was breaking guidance. Now, there's a difference between guidance and a law.
There is.
If guidance becomes law, then we no longer have democracy.
There is, but here's something very interesting about that. I'm like yourself, I'm pretty agnostic about Cummings and what Cummings did. But what I find really interesting is I'd love to have studied anthropology, because I would have thought that a large body of people in this country, upon learning that Cummings had allegedly flouted the guidelines, that they might shift towards thinking, what the hell are we locked down for at all? But they don't, because that's a more rational question, a more reasonable discussion to have. But they pile in on Cummings and on the government, and at the same time demand more lockdown, Kevin. What's happening to people? What's happening to common sense and reason and rationality?
Well, you know, I'm the wrong person to ask here because your listeners will be aware that I was silenced, no platform, by a series of lies 3 years ago, and I've hardly had a voice in the public domain in Ireland and certainly not in Britain anymore because of the lies that were told about me, that I was an anti-Semite, a Holocaust denier, and a misogynist. All these are specific lies. The Jewish community of Ireland denounced the lies. They said, far from being a Holocaust denier, I had told the Irish people more truths about the Holocaust than any other journalist in Irish history. Now, so I was turned into the very opposite of what I am. I have been a long time, as you know, Richie, a publicist for the Irish who served in the Second World War to oppose Hitler. And yet I was turned within the British media and the Irish media into a Holocaust denier. It cost RTE radio and television €200,000. That's what they settled up for on me, for them telling lies about me. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. That you, when the mob lights on you, they will tell lies and they'll get away with lies. Because if you look on the internet, you will see the lies about me survive, and the truth remains invisible. And this is happening day and daily.
So
it's happened for the last 4 or 5 years, aided by that sewer called social media. No, I'm not on the social media scene at all, in any guise, any representation. I'm just not there, and I'm really glad not to be there.
Well, you're not missing
anything.
I'm
astonished how the mainstream media succumb to the filth and the ruin and the lies of the social media. Because there is no way you can filter truth from fiction in that world. And fiction becomes fact, and facts then become an enduring dogma in the public discourse. Now, this is, so you can say that what we're going through now was almost historically inevitable. The closing down of public debate, the closing down of alternative or dissident opinions has been a systematic process over the last 10 years. And it has been incredibly successful. And I cannot help wondering of the role, of the concerted role of California technology bosses in who run these social media organizations. I cannot help but wondering if this is not part of a vast project, not a conspiracy, but a project to make us all think like them, to use their words and to have their concepts and to use terms like multiculturalism and diversity and so on and so forth, till no one knows who they are anymore. It's almost impossible to say, I am, in Britain, I am an Englishman and proud of it, without being called a racist by somebody or other. You can call yourself a Scot and be proud of it, Welsh and be proud of it, Irish and be proud of it. The moment says, I'm an Englishman and proud of it, the Guardian will call you a racist. So we have entered this kind of dead end where nothing but toxicity and filth and ruin awaits anyone who attempts to have a serious grown-up conversation about the crises that face us.
You know, I wouldn't be reticent at all to use the term conspiracy. It's a registered historic fact that the Central Intelligence Agency introduced the term conspiracy theory and theorist to basically defame anybody who was asking any intelligent questions about the murder of Kennedy. And if one or two or three groups of people get together to effect some sort of change, you know, vis-a-vis social media companies, maybe it is a conspiracy theory. A very good mutual friend of ours is asking, listening to this this evening, what do you think is behind it all, even with the lockdown? I mean, it's amazing, she says, how in lockstep the world became so suddenly. Like they, if there is such a thing as they, already knew what to expect. And before you answer that, Kevin, my listeners will be bored of me mentioning this. I was stunned to see an Irish lawyer on Sky News a few weeks ago called Fionnuala Ní Éilean. She's from the West. She works for the United Nations now. And she said she had great suspicion at how, upon hearing that the coronavirus was a serious public health catastrophe, how very quickly, she said, societies and governments and nations around the world very quickly produced reams and reams of documents with new rules and regulations. She said it's almost as if they were in a drawer waiting to be used at some time or another in the future. What do you think?
Well, if that was the case, then they would have some proper arrangement for educating the children, protecting the children, the economic future of their states. I mean, I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong, or Fionnuala or Fidelma. I'm not saying, what I'm saying is that the evidence to me seems a little bit incomplete.
Right.
If there was going to be a blueprint for coping with this, then there would be a blueprint for coping with exams, because the one thing no society wants is suddenly to find in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years' time that haven't got doctors or haven't got teachers or haven't got scientists or haven't got technicians. So that's not the kind of evidence that I find compelling.
No.
I'm not saying that she's wrong. I'm unconvinced by that sort of evidence.
Can I just jump in there because I misrepresented?
The World Health Organization's role in this is deeply sinister.
Yeah.
And Trump was entirely right to withdraw American funding from it for the time being. I mean, Tedros Ghebreyesus, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, the head of the World Health Organization, gave China a free, clean bill of health, and that we know that this is a Chinese disease. It emanated from China, Wuhan province. We know this. It either came from a scientific laboratory where they were making some kind of nerve weapon or whatever, or it came from the food market. You can take your choice, but it came from Wuhan province. When Trump stated this obvious truth that it was a Chinese virus, it wasn't an Irish virus, it wasn't a Manchester virus, it wasn't a Newcastle virus, it wasn't a Swedish virus, it wasn't a Norwegian virus, it was a Chinese virus. He was booed and heckled by the press corps, I mean, almost to a man and woman, toadies of political correctness, for being a racist. It's a Chinese virus. Chinese restaurants are called Chinese restaurants because they're Chinese restaurants. Irish pubs are called Irish pubs because they're Irish pubs, and so on and so forth. So there is a kind of barrier, a protection against the truth here, unlike anything that has occurred in our lifetimes in a democratic society. The only comparison you can make in my lifetime is with the communist states of Eastern Europe and the Far East. Now, they're all gone, but China's not gone. They've transformed their economy into a capitalist economy, but the culture of Marxism remains in the apparatus of the state. And that culture seems to have left the Pacific Ocean and taken root in America. And that's the most extraordinary thing. The undoing of American individualism and its replacement by a general mob, not the kind of mob that we're all acquainted with in the past, the Salem, Salem stuff. We're talking about an entire generation of young Americans, almost an entire generation, seems to have bought the Chinese idea that we must all obey the Big Brother. We must listen to what Big Brother says, and anyone who departs from Big Brother consensus is an evil and wicked person who should be denounced.
The reason why
Trump won 4 years ago was there were enough Americans to deplore what was going on in the country they love. And Americans are very patriotic people, and patriotism is a noble virtue. It's an excellent virtue. And the people of Britain have every reason to commemorate this summer for good reasons, for the patriotism and devotion to the cause of freedom that was shown by the British people in 1940. But patriotism everywhere in the Western world has become unacceptable. It's become a kind of toxic identity when, in fact, it's a noble one. It's an uplifting one. It's a selfless one. It means you do things for other people. And that kind of virtue has been replaced by a new virtue, so that the most extraordinary project that I could identify in this travesty in the last 3 or 4 months is something called protecting the NHS.
Yeah.
As if the NHS was a god. The NHS was the end. The NHS was the great virtue, the great piety. It is not. The NHS is a means to an end, and the end is the wealth and health of the people of Britain. And if the NHS can't do that, then something else is going to have to do it. But protecting the NHS in itself is a contradiction in terms. It's an oxymoron.
I want to go back to 2 or 3 things you said there, just to put a couple of points to you. Let me do that before you come back in, because I know you've got loads to say. On the Wuhan thing, there is circumstantial evidence, I've seen it, that Trump's closest medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was involved in a financial way with medical research into bioweapons in Wuhan itself. Now, that evidence is out there. Right? I'm no conspiracy theorist either, but I want to make that point. The second thing I want to say to you is, I mischaracterised what the Irish lawyer said. That's my fault. she wasn't suggesting that the virus, this was a, you know, a big kind of a made up thing to take people's civil liberties away. What she was actually saying, it's my fault, mea culpa. She was saying, Kevin, that it's been, she believes that it's the long desired position of Western governments, even if it's not the stated desire, that they do get to introduce things like lockdown and tracking people digitally through their phones and all of these things that we could spend hours talking about tonight. She said they would like to be more like these drastic, draconian places you mentioned earlier on, these former communist states. And she said maybe that, you know, they might have been waiting for the opportunity to introduce these measures. Hence the, you know, the documentation was in a drawer, gathering dust for years and years and years. I don't think that's, I'm not saying it's true, but I don't think it's highly unlikely either.
I don't think you're wrong in this regard.
Yeah.
But the instinct to govern is not something in most of us. Most of us would shun the idea, yeah, and would run from the idea of responsibility of government, making decisions over other people's lives. It's a rather unhealthy ambition to have. Yeah. I haven't got it, you haven't got it.
No.
I don't mind talking to people, but I don't want to govern anyone's life. I don't want anyone to have, you know, to have their life altered by some edict I've issued. But the political classes are different from that. They do actually want to alter people's lives. Now, they're never going to say to themselves, never mind to their electorate, I want to control you. I want to limit the number of, you know, outlets or number of opinions you can have. I want to shape your mind so that mind then follows my mind. They're never going to say that to themselves, never mind to the ordinary people. But that's the instinct that's inside them. So when they see the opportunity to get a compliant subject and consensually driven population beneath them, well, that's what they're in politics for. They like controlling people. That gives them pleasure. It gives them a sense of satisfaction. It gives them a sense of self-worth. Most of us get our sense of self-worth from within our own selves. But, you know, it is an existential thing that we are gratified by, you know, the simple pleasures of life, the jobs we do, the love we feel, the sex we enjoy, and all these things. That's not good enough for the political classes. It's quite clear that they love the idea of authority. And if they discover a means of authority that can really get people obeying them, but without any of the apparatus, the visible apparatus of control or coercion, then so much the better, because they can say, look, you're behaving like free people, free men and women. I'm not issuing orders. You are complying with the general wishes of your government, and that's actually rather splendid. And I must confess that the English people and the Scottish people and the Irish people have defied all my expectations of them. I never thought for one second that so many people in these islands would be so compliant,
yeah,
so obedient, so submissive, and so cowed as they have shown themselves to be. There's so little dissent. It's terrifying. I mean, look, if the Stasi were to set up in England today, or in Ireland, or Wales, or Scotland, oh, I don't doubt for one second they couldn't cope with the incoming phone calls about somebody's neighbours. I'm quite sure that would be a norm. I know that the Germans in 1942, when they took over southern France, and not just extended their control to the what had been Vichy control, they couldn't cope with the numbers of complaints by the informers, whatever. The so-and-so was a traitor to the Third Reich. They couldn't cope. There were too many complaints. And I suspect that's the case here, that the degree of unpleasantness in these islands now is without precedent in my experience. And just read the media. I mean, it's horrible reading British newspapers now, listening to the BBC. And the BBC is now the Pravda of British life. It states untruths as truths. I mean, it will present David Attenborough's opinions as God-given facts. David Attenborough is a decent old fellow, but he is not a meteorologist. He is not a weather expert. He's not a climatologist. Yeah, his opinions on that lie only second to Greta Thunberg. I mean, so why would you treat people who are not experts as experts? Because you've been submitted, or you've submitted to the new authority of political correctness.
And it's almost like we collectively, I suppose, as a species, we've forgotten what the media is supposed to be doing and how it should do it. And the how it should be doing it is fascinating. As somebody myself who has on occasion taught radio production through City and Guilds and places. And of course, the perfect example of that was the other evening, the presenter Emily Maitlis breached BBC impartiality in massive style, opening Newsnight by criticising Dominic Cummings and making all sorts of unsubstantiated suggestions in her opening monologue about how the British people felt about it. She was out of order, regardless of what you might think of her as a presenter. She's a pretty decent presenter, as it happens, but she was out of order and she was wrong. But we're into commentary now, not journalism, Kevin.
Well, that's right, and it's not... I don't know what the outcome of that affair was, and I know very little about it, but I do know the Church of England bishops have joined in against Cummings. Yeah. Cummings is not an agent of the Comintern or the Bolshevik Revolution. He's a man who is clearly not a very particularly pleasant one, but no one in political life is.
No.
I mean, you must get that into your head. No one in political life is in politics because he or she wants to improve the ordinary lives, the lives of ordinary people. They're in it for themselves. That's a basic tenet that has to be understood. But he has aroused an animosity which is completely disproportionate to what he actually represents. What he actually represents is, to a large degree, the opinions of the average man and woman in the street of England. He's a Brexiteer.
Yeah.
He believes in Brexit, and actually so do I. And I look forward to the day when there'll be our exit, when Ireland leaves the EU, or the EU ceases to be what it attempts to be, a single unitary state, because that would be a disaster for all of Europe. But anyway, he speaks the ordinary voice of people of Hartlepool and the northeast of England and Cheshire and Manchester, not the voice of the metropolitan elite in London. That's why Emily Maitlis would have felt free to have a go at him, because all her friends in Notting Hill said, oh, he's a terrible man, you are free to say what you like about him, as those same self-same people were saying things about me 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And she would be in an echo chamber and not know that actually north of the Watford Gap, people think and talk quite separately. They've got a clear sense of what it is to be English, or Welsh, or Scottish, or whatever. But they have a clear sense of what it is to be English, and they're not ashamed of that Englishness, unlike people who live in Notting Hill. Now, within the BBC, of course, the BBC is based in London, most of it's based in London, but their mentality is European. They've created this confected identity, which has no identity at all. It has no basis. It has no emotional or military aspect, because you know that no Europeans will die for Europe, but you do know Britons will die for Britain. But so you've got this strange London-based European kind of offshoot, and an offshoot of the Brussels identity, speaking to itself, and they get everything wrong. They got the referendum wrong on Brexit, and they got Trump wrong. They get everything wrong because they don't know what ordinary people think and feel. So Dominic Cummings was held up for an unparalleled abuse. You'd think he was a major war criminal. You'd think he was a man of unspeakable depravity. Well, he's obviously a very eccentric and not particularly pleasant man, but he speaks his mind. But to have the bishops of England lined up one after the other, traducing him, accusing him of being a liar, not one, and that's a very serious accusation.
Without any evidence.
Not one of them was able to prove where he had lied.
Yeah.
He might have been imprudent, he might have been foolish, maybe he should have resigned. But he was looking after his son. It's a very plausible, and there was no one else to do it for him. There were extenuating circumstances, and he didn't break the law. He broke guidelines. And we are all in a pitiful condition indeed if guidelines become mandatory, because they're not guidelines anymore, they're laws.
Yeah, and they want to introduce a digital health passport for everybody to have. This isn't a conspiracy theory. They've admitted as much, and the companies are making them in Manchester. Basically, on our phones would be our digital health passport with all of our information on it. But even worse, those phones would then become payment methods. You've seen this yourself, Kevin. I'm sure you've seen it. People actually
tap. No, I haven't.
Well, people tap.
No, I haven't got a I've got a mobile phone.
But not one of the
technology 20 years old. All it does is make telephone calls.
You've got
it's not social media. We'd never dream of going anywhere near social media. I've got a telephone that my wife can ring me on. Very few people do ring me. But my wife can ring me to tell me to get the bacon.
And
or
don't
forget the
and
bread.
It doesn't do much else. Well, today's phones can be used in the same way that credit cards or debit cards can be used. You can
I
touch
can't.
You can touch them. Yours can't, obviously, but most people's can. You can touch them to a contact point at a supermarket and you pay. Yes.
It's completely stupid.
It's crazy. Right now, here's the point. The point is, these digital passports, they will contain every bit of information about you that is possible to contain, but they will also track your movements and your purchases. Wait for this, I'm not making this up. They will all also, your digital health passport will contain your lifestyle choices on it, how much exercise you take, whether you smoke, whether you drink, and this will all be used to determine when you can go and when you can't go to certain places, outdoor events, theatre shows, concerts or whatever. I know you think your leg's being pulled, but it isn't. It's an absolute fact.
No, I'm this afraid I know you're right.
Yes, where we're
I know
going.
You're right, because the Chinese have once again opined it. Why are we not confronting the Chinese? Why is the Western world so craven before this monstrous state? Not the Chinese people, because the Chinese people don't have any say over the state.
No.
But they are creating the perfect controlled society. They are creating 1984. They are creating Big
I hope he's not lost, Kevin.
Instead of that being an object of terror and of military preparation, because it's quite clear the Chinese have ambitions on South America. They've massively penetrated the Chilean economy and both flanks of Africa. They control vast amounts of territory in Africa, and they control the extraordinary position is you trade with the Chinese, you buy them things from the Chinese, but Chinese don't buy things from you. At the bottom of it, Richie, I think this is a kind of great revenge for the Opium Wars. Now, the Opium Wars was a really scandalous affair, but where the British fought the Chinese in order to, so that they could export opium into the Chinese market, and the Chinese lost. Well, now it's a long time to bear a grudge, but the fact is, the Chinese are behaving in a way that you would never allow any neighbour to behave. You don't allow any neighbour to have two rules. You don't allow him to have late night parties, but he complains when you've got late night parties. When David Cameron met the Dalai Lama in 2011, I think it was, the Chinese almost broke diplomatic relations with Britain because of this.
That's right, yeah, I remember, yeah.
Which is quite shocking. And in the preliminary meetings before David Cameron announced that he was going to put for the rest of his life really large measure of social distancing between him and the Dalai Lama, British officials were brought before the Chinese Foreign Office and were made not merely to write an apology, but to stand up and announce it, to read it in public. Not in public, but before the Chinese officials. And the Chinese head official said, yes, we wanted to hear you say that.
Kevin,
the Chinese state does not respect people that submit to it.
No, I'm going to give you the
respect people that stand up to it.
It
is not in the way of any dictatorship, any despotism, to respect people that lie down in front of them.
Let me give
and
you.
That's what's
let me. I'm just going to say this, and I'm going to give you the final word. Thanks for coming back on. By the way, it's been a real treat to have you on. I don't say that lightly, and I hope you'll come back again sooner rather than later. So I'm going to give you the final word. But what I would say to you is, you described China, what you said about its designs on South America, Latin America, of course, Africa. You are absolutely right. The system the Chinese people live under, despotism, you're absolutely right. But I would say, and you'd expect me as a champagne socialist to say this, I would say, I will see what the Chinese are doing, and I will raise you with the behaviour of France, the UK, the United States, Israel, Germany. I would point to Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen. We could be here all day long, Kevin. You've got two ideologies in the West and in the East, but both of them want to impose their own centralised government on planet Earth. I would argue. Final word to you.
Well, I don't think there's any evidence that the people of the United Kingdom want to impose their way or their will on the people of the earth. I don't think there's much evidence in the United States that want to do that. And the evidence of Chinese penetration is technological and economic. It's quite clearly before our eyes. I don't think the Russians, for example, want to control the world. But the man in President Xi of China is not like anyone else. We don't have to compare with Hitler or Stalin. He's or Mao. He's in a different category. He does believe in the long-term project. He believes in penetration and economic subversion. And what's what we're seeing now? The American economy is essentially controlled by the dollar savings within the Beijing government. They can control the world economy, and that's a project they've been working on for over 30 years. And they have the power to turn on and off the economy, economic wealth of the West and the entire world. Nobody else is doing that. I mean, Russia is accused of all sorts of malfeasance, and he's a terrible man, Putin. But I don't believe he has a project to subvert the United States of America or South America or even Europe. He doesn't want to bully Europe, but he doesn't want to control Europe totally. The Chinese project is quite different. I'm not able to understand it or explain it because it's outside my understanding. But it is something without precedent in world history that I know of, that a country can accumulate power and wealth like this and can release a disease like this. This is the third such disease has emanated from China this century, the third plague. And this is quite an extraordinary event, not merely extraordinary in itself as an epidemic, but the fact that so little comment has been made about this in the Western world, that the people who are receiving these gifts from China are staying silent as the gifts are showered on their head and bringing economic ruin and death to our peoples.
I said you would have the last word. I'm a man of my word. I don't agree with that last point, but we can pick that up again in the future. Very quickly before you go, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, first began reading you when I got my first production job, my first radio job, back in the mid-1990s. I'm not going to blow smoke at you and tell you what an extraordinary writer you are. I've done that before. Why don't you write again? Why don't you put together a website? I am convinced that conservative... I'm not saying you're conservative. I'm not painting you into a corner or putting you in a pigeonhole. But, you know, publications like Spiked Online, there are many of them that have writers, sadly, on the right. I say sadly because I'm a socialist. I think people would fall over themselves to republish you. I really would love to see you do that, Kevin. You're an important voice.
Well, thank you, Richie. We'll see what happens.
All right, my friend. Thanks for giving us your time today. Go back to the sunshine. Thanks,
Kevin.
All the best, mate. Thanks for that. I love to have him on the programme. Kevin Myers, live from Dundalk in Ireland. Great writer, great broadcaster. Used to bring him on WLRFM back in my time as producer there. He presented Challenging Times for years in Ireland as well. A national radio, of course, in television, and wrote for the Times and the Sunday Times and lots of other newspapers as well. And as he mentioned earlier on, he was deplatformed for no good reason back in 2017. Kevin Myers live on the Richie Allen radio show. The time is exactly 6 minutes past the hour. Tell you what I'll do. Give me a minute. I'm going to take a tune. I might need to take two, and I will open Skype and I will open the phone. I'm going to ask you, because I'm only going till 7 o'clock. Why, BBG? Why? Because it's 43 degrees in the studio. It really is. I've got this beautiful studio. It's better than any BBC studio you've ever seen. The equipment, I've got everything. But I don't have aircon, but I will have in the next couple of weeks. Because I'm not going through July and August like last year. I'm going till 7 o'clock. So, hang on. If you want to talk to me, you can do so for free by using Skype. It is Chat with Richie, all one word. Skype Chat with Richie. If you don't have Skype and you'd like to phone me, it is 0161 818 2018 outside of the UK, +44 161 818 2018, and the meme containing the information I've just given you is pinned to Caroline's backside. No, it isn't. It's pinned to the top of Facebook and Twitter as well. Here's the Bee Gees. I'm telling you, live from Salford in Greater Manchester, the Richie Allen Radio Show. Best in the world. Yeah, the Bee Gees on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Thursday show, live from Salford. 43 degrees in the studio. It's probably about 23 outside. We're going to move these calls along as quick as we can. I won't be rude. You know I love you. The BBG loves you. Nobody else might love you, but I loves you. I loves you. We're going straight to the phones. Caller, welcome to the programme. Who am I speaking with?
Yeah, very good afternoon, Richie. It's Andy Newman here, calling from Bristol.
Andy Newman in Bristol. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing all right, mate. I'm doing all right.
I might be able to hear myself in the background, so turn me down, Andy, and then come back and have a chat with me.
I will turn you down, mate.
Turn me down. I'm loud enough as it is. We don't need me twice in stereo.
Yeah, better, isn't it?
Hey, Andy, lovely to chat with you. I bet you're boiling to death there in Bristol. It's warm.
It is warm. I'm inside in the shade. Occasionally, I do go outside and get some of those magic rays on me, you know, get the vitamin D and everything. It's nice to be able to chat to you again after being banned from Twitter. I managed to come back under another name.
Did you get kicked out of Twitter, did you?
I did. I got kicked out of Twitter for something I said about Extinction Rebellion.
Was it rude, Andy? You can tell me. Nobody's listening. What did you say about Extinction Rebellion?
Well, it was probably conceived to be rude, but it wasn't meant to be. Let's put it that way. But that's beside the point. I mean, I'm back under another name now. People might recognise me as Open OAP, which stands for Open-Minded Old Age Pensioner.
This is a serious issue, Andy, right? We're going to move the calls along quickly, but I'm not going to dump you off. I want to keep you on for a minute because I'm enjoying listening to you. I've got loads backed up. This is a serious issue. Whatever you think about Trump or don't think about him, it seems that Trump said something about, you know, ballot boxes and stuffing ballot boxes in California. It seemed to be fairly benign. It seemed also that he might have had a point. And then Twitter put some information underneath his tweet basically saying that it needed to be fact-checked. What's going on with Twitter and Facebook? Why are we even talking about this still? Go ahead, Andy.
Well, it's the same with YouTube, Richie. I mean, if you go onto anybody's YouTube channel and they post anything that's even slightly different from the accepted narrative, then YouTube put a note on there saying about this website.
Yeah.
You know, and they try and point you in another direction. I mean, a typical example is Dr. Vernon Coleman.
Yeah.
Who Peter Ebdon mentioned the other day, and
I
tweeted you about. I mean, he's saying some remarkably interesting things in short YouTube videos that last about 10 minutes. And he's saying more sense in 10 minutes than the entire mainstream media do since this whole farce began.
He's pretty sharp, isn't he? I've reached out to him, by the way. He's not an easy man to get. I think Peter might have contact details for him, so I'm going to invite him on the programme.
He calls himself an old man in a chair.
That's right. What this very learned guy is doing is he's saying, look, there's another way to look at the virus and the lockdown. And yet underneath his posts, YouTube are basically saying, this guy's a bit strange now. It's what they're doing, effectively, right?
They're suggesting that, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, but I think the bottom line is, Richie, and I won't hog the phone any longer than I have done, people do not like to be told they are wrong. People do not like to be told that they've been fooled. And even people of my generation, and some of them quite close friends of mine over the last few years, get up in the air if I try and say to them, look, it's really pretty damn obvious that we're being conned here.
Being had.
And you know, they say, oh, no, you're a conspiracy theorist and all that kind of stuff. And that's all that people have got to come back to it. All I ask is that if I post something on Facebook or Twitter or anything else that people don't agree with, go out and do their own research and see what they come up with.
How, just before you go, Andy, thanks for calling in, by the way. I've got Andre, who's in Australia, next. And then we're off to Bulgaria, I believe. It's hectic. It's nice. I love that. Before we go, how did we get there? How did we get to that place where, as people, we get personally offended when somebody disagrees with an opinion? How did we get there? Or were we always there?
Well to an extent, we were always there. Probably the rise of social media, and particularly Twitter and Facebook, obviously, being the two main ones.
Well, I hope
you're still mob rule. It's become mob rule. Say something that people don't like, and they're on you like a ton of bricks, as your journalist colleague.
You love that, don't you? Don't you love this phrase, Twitter, do your thing, an incitement to bully and harass somebody because they said something that is deemed unsayable? You mentioned, before I take Andre in Australia, you mentioned OAP. You're not an OAP, Andy, are you?
I am, yeah, I am 66.
I tell you what.
Yes, I am an OAP.
The reason I ask that is because the people who stream me and the people who look after the podcast, they struggle to try and get any handle on the demographic. They have no idea, really. And to be honest with you, I don't either. I think it's just great, really. You know, you'd like to know, is it 45 to 70-year-olds? Is it 20-year-olds to 50? You know, you'd like to know. You might be able then to... you know, in terms of going to advertising companies, you might be able to try and make some money, but we just don't have a clue, really. But no, it makes me laugh that. And you're loved.
I think you've got listeners of all ages all over the world, Richie, and long may it continue.
I would guess so, Andy. Listen, mate, you're very kind. Thanks for sharing that with us. Yeah, it's a tragedy that, I mean, judging by what you've been saying, you've not been insulting people or using bad language against people, but then they delete your account or delete. This is the way we're going in 2020.
The thing is that you don't get any comeback. Your account's deleted, and you appear.
You can't challenge it,
and they just send you an automatic electronic sort of email thing that says the same thing over and over again. It's as if you're actually talking to a computer, and you probably are.
Andy, you have a brilliant weekend, mate. Thanks very much for phoning in. Love to hear from you today. That was Andy in Bristol. And we're off to Australia next to speak to Andrea, who got in touch earlier on today, actually. Let me know that she was going to be around. So she's an ex... Well, she's not an ex, because if you're a Geordie, you're always a Geordie. She's an expat living down under. Andrea, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, Richie. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Which part of Oz are you in?
I'm in North Queensland, a place called Mackay on the east coast.
So is it stupid o'clock then Friday morning there?
It is. I got the alarm set at 10 to 3 this morning. I was so excited I could hardly sleep.
My head is five times the size it was when I came into the studio. I never get that sort of compliment. Well, thanks for it's lovely to meet you first and foremost. I know you've been listening to programmes like this for a while. What's it like then, North Queensland? What's lockdown been like for you there?
It really hasn't been as harsh as what the English people have gone through. I speak with my family regularly and can't believe that you can't even get a coffee. We've never had a McDonald's close. We've never had the restaurants have set aside their tables, but you can still get takeaways. They've jumped onto Uber Eats. And yes, we had the toilet paper issue and the flour and what have you. But really, life has continued pretty much as normal.
That's very interesting now, because it hasn't been normal here. And you obviously know that because you'll have friends and family over here. It hasn't been. Is that a cultural thing, do you think? Are Australians a little bit more rebellious? I mean, it's a country full of criminals, isn't it? It's the descendants of our worst. Well, it isn't really. But do you think they're a bit more inclined towards rebellion? What do you think?
I don't know whether it's a rebellion thing. It's just they haven't had any evidence it didn't get to a media frenzy the way it did in the UK. Right. And people are looking around going, well, I don't see anybody sick. I haven't heard of anything. One isolated case, two isolated cases. They did close down the borders, so they did lock it down in that regard. But we are not in winter. We are just heading into winter now. It could have been that it takes, as you say, the flu season or something like that, which we haven't had.
Of course. I should have thought of that. That's right. Yeah, you're at the tail end of autumn now, heading into winter. Maybe at some stage, and let's hope not, but maybe at some stage somebody will say that the virus is prevalent and maybe things will change. How fascinating that is. And that's, such a vast country. So different regions of the country then have taken different approaches, would you say, to it?
Absolutely, because they've got their state law. Each state has taken a different slant on things, opening up in different states, you know, gatherings of 10. Restaurants can now take up to 10, or depending on the size, the patrons, so you're well spaced out. You have to leave your name and address when you go there to eat. And the restaurant keeps that information. They don't actually hand it over to the government.
Leave your name and address. So, but I tell you what, Andrea, yes. That is sinister, that, isn't it? I mean, even that alone is terribly sinister. Leave your name and address so that they can keep track of whom you're accompanying to the restaurant. Is that it?
Well, it's for safety. That's what they're saying. And luckily, it doesn't go from the restaurant to the government until, say, there was an outbreak, and then they would start, you know, investigating. But just the fact they feel awful, they'll apologise and say, look, we're sorry, but if you're going to dine here, would you please leave your name and address, at least one of you. So, yeah, that is a bit strange. And the same as the track and trace, they're doing all of this. Hey, I've got heaps to say. Max Igrin's been kicked off Facebook.
Max has been booted off of Facebook. When did that happen?
I don't know when it happened, but I just thought, oh, I haven't seen anything from him. That's gone.
The page is gone. And he had, as far as I can remember, he had hundreds of thousands of followers there.
Yep, he did. Yeah. So, yeah, that's happened. But yeah, it's madness. I was talking to my niece. She's in Yorkshire. She doesn't know anybody who's had the virus. They're just unbelievable. And there's nobody I know has had this or knows anybody who's had it.
And I have to say the same thing. I know back around Christmas and right through January and early February, I was particularly unwell, but I don't know what that was, you know.
No, I was exactly the same. I flew to the UK to have Christmas with my family and we all got sick. And my husband, who you can't drag him to a doctor, he hates them. He took himself. He was that worried about this chest infection. The doctor looked at it and it was clear as, you know, mucus or anything like that. It was just a real bad cough. He couldn't catch his breath and things like that. And the doctor said, oh, well, look, I'll give you some antibiotics. And he had to take two courses to shake it. And he's a fit, healthy bloke.
And if it was a virus, the antibiotics were useless anyway.
And, exactly.
And eventually his system cleared it out. That's exactly what happened to me. No mucus. I would get chest infections fairly regularly. I'm bloody open to them. And after a while, you begin to break up the mucus and you don't feel so bad and you can breathe easier. This particular time, there was nothing blocking, but the breathing was absolutely down to its worst. And when I heard this emergency room doctor in New York talking about altitude sickness, I began to wonder, what is this? That's why I don't say that there was no virus. Something was definitely going around. But like you today, I don't know anybody who's been ill. The hospital, Salford General, is not full. It's not even remotely near full. It hasn't been at any time during the so-called pandemic. And, you know, these Nightingale hospitals are empty. They haven't been used. Nurses and doctors seem to be able to find time to put on plays and concerts and stuff, you know. And you wonder...
It's unreal. And like, I've got friends on Facebook over there, they're absolutely terrified. They're like, well, I'm not rushing back to work, and there's, you know, this danger, and they're getting Boris Johnson, oh, he's a useless so and so. And I'm looking at them thinking, you haven't got a clue. You've followed the herd in the beginning, and now you're criticising him because they probably know it's nothing.
This is
that
it,
it's
yeah.
not as serious. That, you know, if it is out there, well, you can recover quite easily from it.
Let me put this to you. I'm keeping you on now for a bit because you get up at 10 to 3 in the morning. If I get rid of you now, I'll be the biggest bastard of all time. So you better stay with me for a couple of more minutes. Let me ask you this. Do you think... it's occurred to me, it's not my, this isn't my brainwave, I did read this in one of the newspapers, but maybe a lot of us have jobs that we do, and we do them solely to survive. We don't do them out of any great love for them. A lot of jobs for people are soul-destroying, even if they pay well. You know, jobs are monotonous, and, you know, it's a terrible thing. I could be here all day talking about it. I wonder how many people want the lockdown to continue for a period because they're fed up with their jobs and they're happy to be furloughed and to be paid 90% of their wages to sit in the garden, Andrea, in this gorgeous weather. What do you think?
That's right. Absolutely. I've got a friend who fits that description 100%. Happy as a little pig in shit that he has had some house renovations. He's got into his gardening. He's as brown as a berry because the sun's been so kind to you. And he does not want to go back to work next week. He would like it to continue. So I think there's some people who are saying, oh, I'm really scared. It's not that they're scared. It's just that they're using that as an excuse not to go back to work.
Yeah. And you know, part of me has great sympathy for them because they've got friends, not just here in the UK, but back home. And their jobs depress them. And they've enjoyed not being to work for the last 6 or 7 weeks. They're loving it. And I've been wondering, are you some of these anonymous accounts trolling, you know, online, saying that we need to have more lockdown and criticising people like Cummings? I don't know, but it's strange. What about the future then, Andrea? Just finally, and thanks for getting up and coming on and talking to me. What about the future and the so-called new normal? That's scary stuff, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because I've got older relatives who are buying into this, you know, distancing, and they're just compliant. That's what really I cannot believe is how many people are just taking this lying down.
Yeah, the compliance. Yeah,
it's like, to me, it's like a social experiment.
Yeah, Kevin talked about it in the first hour of the program. His shock. Everybody seems to be absolutely stunned at how people have gone. I mean, forget the because before anybody realised that they could have time off of work and get paid for it, before all of that, people were very quick to obey, weren't they? They were, immediately.
Yep. Total fear. I've looked at the stats myself. It's no different to the 2018 flu epidemic or flu season or whatever you want to call it.
No, it isn't. Are you a lady, Andrea, are you a lady who, I can't make assumptions, are you somebody who likes to shop? Do you like to go and browse and shop and look at clothes? I would imagine most women do. I know a lot of guys who do. Do you like to do that? I mean, look at what they're saying to people like you. They're saying that, well, which is nearly everybody, they're saying that from now on, one exit and one entrance for the shops. You've got to keep metres apart inside the shop. There will be hand sanitizers. If you happen to try on a pair of shoes, Andrea, and the future Mrs. Allen wants to try them on, and it's the only pair in the shop, well, tough shit, Paddy. They're going to go into quarantine for 24 hours. This is madness, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really is. And people will just accept it.
They'll just accept it.
And I don't know is this the aluminium? Have we had our, you know, intelligence suppressed?
Sucked out of us. How did you end up in Oz? Did you marry an Australian? Is that how you ended up out there?
Yes, yeah, I did. And it's funny, the first marriage didn't work, but the second one's fabulous. And I've made it my home. I still miss Blighty, the family connection and things like that. But yeah, it's a new way of life.
You're loving it out there. I wouldn't go there for all the money in the world. And the truth, and I've said this before, and the truth is, I shouldn't give this away really. Spiders and creepy crawlies. There's no way you could get me there. And you've got massive stuff. You've got everything. It's Jurassic Park out there. Let's be honest.
It is.
And you're out there. Yeah.
And I watched Jaws at a very impressionable age, and I'm convinced there's sharks in swimming pools at night time.
So it's not just you see there's me just thinking creepy crawlies. Of course, even if you went to the beach, I know you're telling me swimming pools as well. Thanks for getting up, by the way, and thanks for connecting.
You're welcome. Honestly, Rich, I've been listening to you for years. You are doing an amazing job. Hang in there, please keep going. We need re-educating. We need some norm. We need sanity people around us.
We need to have a giggle every now and then, don't we?
I've got my son hooked on you. He's 14. Him and I have been listening to you for a good few years, and even down to Gardasil.
Oh, that's lovely. What's his name, Andrea? What's your son's name?
Jamie.
It's Jamie. He's in bed, obviously. If he does listen to this later on, Jamie, how you doing? Thanks for listening.
He thrilled. He said, can I get up, Mum? I said, no, you forgot to go to school. So No, he will. He'd be thrilled about that. But no, they tried to give God a soul to boys here, and I said, no way. And I let him listen to the podcast. And so yeah, he's got an understanding. He's not scared of the virus. He never has been from the beginning.
There you went now. There you went and said something else that's bloody interesting. Hang on a second now. So Gardasil, of course, which is the nonsense vaccine for human papillomavirus, which nobody needs anyway. No. And they wanted to give it to boys. Well, they do want to, not just down under, but everywhere. And you, amazingly, are saying, my son is not having it. Was there any opposition to to Jamie not having it?
No, there wasn't. It was a consent form. And I just said no to that. He was due his last booster, which I was kind of pressurized into, like his dad's into vaccines and stuff like that, gets a flu shot every year religiously. And I said, well, look, I'll take him to our own doctor so that I would be present. I did my best to get him healthy and give him all this, you know, a supplement before and after, because I was terrified in case there was any adverse effects. And he did actually come out with a rash, which in a way was a blessing, because I took him back to the doctor and the doctor agrees with me that possibly he shouldn't have any more vaccines. So it kind of worked out quite well. Yeah, that it's on his records. But I did object to that Gardasil, and I know from what you've said and I've done my own research on it that we don't need it. It's
of course
disgusting.
We don't. Women don't need it.
No, and it was actually a Scottish scientist or whatever who was working in Australia with a government grant who came up with the damn thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're basically saying, this is going to sound very crass, but you're basically saying if you insist that a girl has it, you're basically saying you're a slut. Or you might be, you know, promiscuous or whatever. It's ridiculous. Andrea, I've got calls coming in from all over the bloody place. I'll take a few more. No, listen, I've loved having you, by the way. I've loved listening to you. So thanks, and give Jamie your regards and your husband as well. And I'm sure we'll hook up again in the future. And thanks for listening.
Oh, awesome, Richie. You're doing an amazing job. Thank you for your time.
You're very
kind. Thanks, listeners, for being patient.
It was not at all. It was brilliant. It was fascinating, very interesting, very important information there. Yeah. They want the boys to have Gardasil. The boys. Look, that's a whole other programme. I think we've done it to death anyway. I've got a mobile call coming in now. Somebody who's been exceptionally patient. Exceptionally patient. Caller, welcome to the programme. Who am I speaking with?
Hello. Hi there, Richie. This is Julian. We spoke at Christmas when I'd come back from Syria.
We did, Julian.
It was a very long time ago.
Welcome back, mate. How are you?
Great to speak to you again. And my goodness, it feels like a different world that we're in.
It is.
Now. And a good question someone asked me was, why is it called social distancing and not physical distancing?
That's a really good point, isn't it? Who came up with that term and why? Words are so important, aren't they, for the people behind these agendas? Phrasing things is very important, yeah.
Well, look, I've got some more words from you. Maybe you can tell me where they come from.
Go on.
A little quiz for you on the Richie Allen Show. The horrible thing about the 2 minutes hate was not that one was obliged to act a part, but that it was impossible to avoid joining in.
You've stumped me, Julian.
Well, I wonder if the listeners will know. It's from 1984.
I was going to guess 1984. Because I've read 1984, but if I say that, I'll get it wrong. How prescient in 2020, eh?
Yeah, well, it feels like that every Thursday night, and tonight's the last one. It always reminds me of the 2 minutes hate. And I think it's been called off before it petered out or turned into something else.
Is that right? Because the woman allegedly responsible for this clap for the NHS, she's been doing the rounds of the media today saying that we should end it now because it's become something different. It served its purpose. But you think that it was just going to die out anyway, naturally, of its own volition?
It might have died out, or people were trying to start a boo for Boris.
Maybe, yeah.
So you never know. But,
that goes. Sorry, Julian.
Strange times.
We live in strange times. That goes to what we've been speaking about all evening, really. this kind of acquiescence of people. My jaw was dropping. Listen, I could find some way to understand on the first Thursday when people who had been scared basically shitless by their media and by their government, and they believed that their nurses and doctors were really in imminent danger. So they believed it. So on Thursday 1, I could understand some people saying, okay, let's join in with this neighbourly clap and all that. But by the second and third one, I couldn't believe that people were still getting involved in it. And yet they were. Unquestioning, you know, almost full of fervour and passion. What's happened to us? How have we become so acquiescent? Or again, were we always...
Absolutely. Well, and people who voted for the party that tried to destroy the NHS seem to clap the loudest. I don't know whether that's because they feel guilty. We've had the, what's he called, Sergeant Tom, Captain Tom, whatever he was promoted to, marching up and down, and everyone getting so behind that, which reminded me very much of, do you remember the film, where they talk about Good Old Shoe. I forget the name of the film, but they have this propaganda campaign and all of a sudden everyone gets behind it. And it's a complete sort of, they have a made up war. What's it called? Wag the Dog. That's it.
Wag the Dog. Dustin Hoffman, if I remember. That's right.
Yeah. And it's all just, it turns out to be completely fake, but it's this way of everyone getting behind it, getting behind the campaign, and it goes viral, as many things do these days. But are we just parroting what we're being told to say?
I don't hold much hope, really. I don't want to be saying this. I don't want to be bringing people's moods down or upsetting people. But when I see that level of acceptance of the agenda, when I see that level of participation, Julian, I don't really have too much hope for what's coming down the line in terms of whether we'll be able to prevent it. However, I am beginning to believe, I mean, I totally believe that the weather, our global temperatures will plummet by the end of this next decade, the so-called Maunder minimum, and things are going to change. I wonder if nature will come to our rescue. And I don't mean some cataclysmic weather event, but whether, you know, when that happens, whether people will begin to understand at that stage that they've been hoodwinked, they've been lied to, they've been had, and maybe then there'll be some social change. But until then, I hold no hope, mate. I think the more they're spoon-fed, the more misery heaped upon them, the more they'll go along with it. What do you think?
Well, I'll leave you with a... not a quote, but I'm going to paraphrase Malcolm X, because I saw quite a good video the other day with a clip of him saying that during the Second World War, the US was able to convince the public to hate Germany and Japan and love China and Russia because they were on their side.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the war was over, they very quickly told them the complete opposite, and China and Russia became the victims of the two-minute hate. Once again, so we seem to just follow along very, very quickly.
That is an amazing point you've just made there, Julian. And the often mentioned late great Jim Mars once spoke about that very thing to me. US attitudes towards China and Russia pre-war and post-war. And Jim said to me once, I'll never forget it, he said, Richie, it was almost like wrestling, where the character, the actor, one month he's a heel, he's a bad guy. Yeah. Next month he's turned into a good guy and, you know, he's the victim. And the public, the crowds that turn up to the wrestling, they don't bat an eyelid, they just go along with it. Amazing, really.
Well, great show, Richie.
Julian, you're a gent, mate. Morning. Thanks for calling in again. Lovely to hear from you. Good to speak to you. And we're going to Andy in Surrey now. Andy's been waiting a while to get on as well. So it's Andy in Surrey. And there are plenty of calls coming in. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, Thursday's programme. If you're just joining the programme, Kevin Myers was with me in the first hour. It's an extraordinary conversation. Don't miss it. It'll be on Spotify, Podomatic, YouTube, the usual, later on in the evening. Andy's in Surrey. Welcome to the programme, Andy. Good to have
Hi there, my friend.
Have you come indoors from sun? Have you come into the shade?
It's been a hot one, isn't it, today?
It's been glorious today, yeah. It's warm in studio up here. Tell me this, I'm delighted that you've got in touch today, because Boston Dynamics robots on your mind, Andy. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, it's the something that's caught my attention. It's been a few news posts, BBC, Wired and others. The use of drones and these Boston Dynamic robots for, you know, battling coronavirus. And you had a guest on last month, I think it was, Mark McFarlane, the 5G engineer. And he was kind of, you know, trying to, you know, get through to your listeners what 5G might all be about. I've got a different take on it. See, I think the whole Internet of Things, which 5G will enable, it's going to enable things like drones and robots, you know, automated systems, basically, to be patrolling the streets completely unsupervised as such. And the thing is, you know, we're talking about an economic collapse coming in the next, you know, 12, 18 months or whatever. You know, crime rates potentially going to go through the roof, you know, rioting, you know, police cuts because there's no money to pay for it. But what's going to be the solution? You know, they always throw technology at us. So maybe we need an army of drones to be patrolling, you know, the skies. We need, you know, robot dogs on the street. It sounds mental.
It doesn't, Andy, it doesn't, because I've seen Gareth, David's son, Gareth, I follow Gareth on Twitter.
Yeah.
He's been posting some videos of these dogs, these Boston Dynamic robot dogs.
Doing in Singapore right now.
Yeah, doing stuff like giving people messages, but also even, dare I say this, did I see a video where they were herding sheep or other animals or something like that? So they're that sophisticated already. Yes.
So, yeah, and they're promoting it. So if you go on BBC News, you'll see, you know, maybe once a week, if you dig into the technology section, you'll see, you know, posts about these things. And the thing with Boston Dynamics is, I mean, they're funded by DARPA. So that's the research arm of the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And they came out of MIT, and they were originally Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And their kind of raison d'etre was to build military robots. That's what they're founded to do. So now they've kind of moved into this more kind of civilian kind of arm, where they're, you know, putting out these robot dogs or whatever, but their DNA is absolutely military, right? It's right from the Pentagon. At one point they were owned by Alphabet, which is obviously the, you know, the parent company of Google. They've since been sold. So we have to really keep an eye on what this company is up to. And there's a paper on their website, actually. You go to bostondynamics.com/COVID-19, and they list all of the things that they want to be doing next, you know, like remote surveillance, putting body temperature sensors on these dogs, you know, being able to measure respiratory rate, pulse rate, you know, oxygen saturation, basically, you know, to be patrolling, to sort of monitor our vital signs as we're going about our business. And it just sounds... I know it sounds crazy. Anyone who's listening to this who hasn't come across this before will think, who is this guy? He's talking absolute rubbish.
No, but you're not, as you said yourself.
This technology exists. It's ready to go. They're just waiting for the crisis, right?
And you think 5G then would enable these things to be controlled, but also enable them to communicate between themselves?
They're communicating. Yes, exactly what they do. So the drones, you can imagine, you know, 1,000 drones in the sky.
Yeah.
All connected on their own private Wi-Fi network. So they're talking to each other. You know, if there's a disturbance in one part of the city, you could, you know, have swarms of these drones all converging at the same point. You know, I mean, who knows where this is going to go, right? Start fitting tasers on them. I mean, it sounds crazy. But...
Do you think then, when you think back, I know you will have seen it, everybody has seen it, Terminator, 1984, whenever it came out.
Yeah.
So they envisaged the future whereby the machines would become self-sufficient and would begin to make their own decisions. And you look at this stuff, they've got these drones. They've been flying over cities in France telling people to get indoors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure, I mean, was that predictive programming then, Andy, back in... the 1980s.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? So we always, I think we look at the technology that's in the public arena now and we think that's the cutting edge. there's so much of this stuff. You know, this is, I would imagine this technology has been in the deep underground bunkers, you know, 30
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah.
You know, military technology, top secret, above top secret, already designed, ready to go, waiting. And like all these things, Richie, it's always, I know it gets a bit cliche, doesn't it? The whole problem, reaction, solution thing. But it is, it's a problem. What is the problem? Well, it's COVID-19. Solution, well, we can't have human contact because that spreads the virus. Well, what do we have as an alternative then? Well, we better start sending robot dogs and drones out because, you know,
yeah,
they spread the virus.
They've been delivering parcels in parts of the UK. Yeah. Drones have in this country.
And you just have to wonder, where does it end, you know? I mean, like I said a few minutes ago, I think a bang on the money, there's going to be an absolute economic collapse, the likes of which we've never seen. And it kind of terrifies me, right? Because if you think of where that leads, I mean, crime rate, I know it sounds really depressing here, but, you know, crime's going to go through the roof, rioting, there's just going to be, it's going to be a pretty bleak future if we don't sort this out.
Friend of mine said to me the other day, I won't mention which friend, and he said, over the next 12 months or so, Richie, he said, maybe you might want to think about keeping, this is true now, I'm going to say, I might get into trouble for saying this. He said, you might want to think about keeping a weapon or two at your property. And I said, not in a million years. And he said, I'm telling you, get a license to have a shotgun. You can get one and have one. I said, no, I'm never going to own a gun. Well, he said, get a couple of baseball bats or a couple of hurleys, which is the Irish sport, of course, hurling, or get a cricket bat or something. He said, because when it gets really bad, Richie, and people have nowhere else to go, they'll turn on each other in communities in ways that we never imagined. He said to me, my man.
Yeah, I think this is the worrying thing, is that civilization... There's a lot of very good people out there, but I think civilization as a whole is quite a thin veneer. And once you start taking food away and you start taking security away, you know, those that are, let's say, more inclined towards violence, you know, they won't need an excuse anymore. It will just become instinct.
Let me ask you, Andy, because you've looked into it a little bit. I'm not putting you on the spot at all I don't want to put you on the spot. Does Boston Dynamics have capable, upward standing humanoid type robots? Do they? Yes. Are they any good?
Yes, they're incredible. You go onto YouTube, I can't remember the names of them, but if you just type in Boston Dynamics human robot, they've got ones which can literally dance, they can jump fences. If you push them over, they can right themselves and get back standing again.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, and those were the ones that were originally funded by DARPA. They were going to be the kind of military, like, alternative to human soldiers. And then the Pentagon kind of pulled the project by saying they were too loud, too noisy to be used. But, you know, it's been designed, and now they've gone into these dogs. And the thing is, you go and look at these robot dogs, they call it Spot. And I know you own dogs, Richie. They move and they act like a dog. You know, they have all the same mannerisms. I'm surprised you haven't stuck a tail on it, you know?
But this takes me back to the Japanese Tamagotchi bollocks and all that. Do you remember that, Andy?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I'm old enough to remember that.
But no, I'm not saying that for a giggle. I'm sure people, you know, it might sound a bit funny. I don't mean you laughing, but people might say, oh, that's funny. But again, the idea that you would have a pet that isn't, it isn't biological. It isn't, it's not flesh and blood. It's a bloody robot.
It's a mechanical pet. And that's what these, so if you look at the, if you just go on to BBC from a couple of weeks ago, you can see this one patrolling Singapore. And it's all kind of gimmicky, right? You've got the people there with their smartphones taking pictures of it, and it kind of looks, you know, cute and funny. But then you just have to think, well, where, you know, they're not, this stuff hasn't been designed to be just a gimmick, right?
Yeah.
You don't pump billions of dollars into something just for it to be a gimmick. It's, you know, it's deadly serious. And we might start to see in the next few years, you know, what this type of technology, you know, can actually do.
Wouldn't you love to get a hold of the police officers in Minneapolis who suffocated a man to death on on Monday, George Floyd.
Yeah, shocking, wasn't it?
Shocking. And I'm not trying to virtue signal by bringing it up, not in the least now. But wouldn't you love to say to these bastards, you know, wouldn't you love to say, you know what, guys, this is what's going to replace you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
I mean, this look in the mirror. 10 years from now, this will replace, you know, in the smart cities, there aren't going to be human police officers. There's going to be drones, and there's going to be a few kind of civilian operators that are very well paid. But it's mostly going to be patrolled, you know, armies of drones, armies of robot dogs and whatever on the streets. And you say about predictive programming, there's a book from the 1950s by quite a famous author called Ray Bradbury. It's called Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
And in that, he talks about mechanical dogs armed with tranquilizer darts that go around hunting down the dissidents.
Jesus Christ.
And that was 1950.
1950, yeah.
Yeah. So this stuff isn't, you know, it's been considered for a long time.
I wonder if any of these writers...
You know, we're ready.
This is it, Andy. No, sorry to interrupt you, mate. I shouldn't be interrupting you. It's your slot here. I wonder how many of these writers... This is stupid now. This is out of left field. We suspect that time is not linear. I wonder how many of these guys, you know, weren't just very good at predicting stuff. I wonder how many of them actually got a glimpse of it somehow.
Well, Aldous Huxley.
Yeah.
You know, the rumour is that he was a deep insider, you know, and then he wrote Brave New World based on, you know, on the information he'd been given, because that was, you know, what, 1920s, early 1930s, yeah, he wrote that book.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's talking about DNA manipulation. He's talking about, you know, genetic modification of humanity, kind of all the crazy, crazy stuff we see now.
I have a final question for you. There is one mobile call that's been trying to get in for ages, just like you. By the way, thanks for your patience, by the way. Just before I take the final call, is there any getting out of this, Andy, do you think? Have we any chance of getting out of it before it happens?
Do you know what? This is... I'm not sure. I tend to side a little bit here with Max Eigen, who thinks it's already gone too far. I don't think we're ever going back to the way things were before. If we're gonna build something good from this world, we have to start telling the truth as human beings, because that's why we're in this mess, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because our civilization's built on deception. From the ground up, you know, we tell, you know, I myself, I'm not perfect. I tell lies and I'm guilty of that. But it kind of permeates throughout our entire society. And I think that's how we've allowed ourselves to be occupied the way that we have. I mean, you look at these politicians we've got now, they just, you know, wouldn't trust them to tell the time in a room full of clocks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So and people have to... I think people need to come to the understanding that they're basically managers of public life. They don't obviously come up with these policies that they manage. They come from elsewhere, and people need to understand that, but we don't.
Maybe as a final point here, Richie.
Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe things just have to get a little bit worse before they start to get a bit better.
Maybe enough.
Start thinking.
That's it, Andy. Maybe there's a tipping point. Maybe there's an event that might transpire. Something might happen where it does shake people in a way that, you know, never happened before. I hope so. Thanks for coming back on, Andy. Lovely to chat with you again. I know it's been a long time since you were on.
It has, yeah. Jeremy Corbyn had just been elected last time.
The last time you spoke to me, so that's 3.5, nearly 4 years ago, last time you came on the programme. I remember you well. Because I do have a great memory like that. Thanks so much, mate. Lovely to have you on. And thanks for all that info about Boston Dynamics. It's fascinating.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Thanks, cheers, Andy. Mate. Bye for now. That was Andy. And I'm going to take one final call now. I've got 3 minutes to take this. Very patient caller. Caller, welcome to the programme. Who am I speaking with?
Hello.
Hi, who am I speaking to?
Hi, Richie. I wasn't sure if you were talking to me. It's Melanie from Newcastle. I've spoken to you before.
You have in the past, Melanie. Welcome back. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting so long. I really, really mean that. It's been fairly busy. We've got about 3 minutes left, so I'm going to shut up, Melanie, and I'm going to give you the floor. Go ahead.
Well, the reason I called, Richie, is because you keep referring to anthropology. And I graduated in sociology and anthropology quite a long time ago. And what it does is it gives you a lens to look at the world and that might be a bit of a curse because it's not a very nice world to be looking at right now.
No, but at the same time, it must be fascinating, Melanie. I mean, it must be. I mean, studying human behaviour. I mean, have you been surprised by the public's reaction to what's been happening?
I've been mortified, actually, because I've followed the likes of yourself and, you know, the alternative media for a very, very, well, since the early 90s. So I've kept abreast of, you know, of thinking and seen too much evidence of wrongdoing by people who, you know, are in charge.
Yeah.
And this movement towards an elite takeover, I mean, it's just, you know, and now we have it. It's glaringly obvious to me, which is horrible. I wish it wasn't, but that's how it seems.
That's how it feels. Yeah. And it seems like it's happened really quickly. I know that it's been building up, like you just said there, Melanie, it's been building up for many years. We've seen the signs of it. But it almost seems like in the last few months, it's like it just accelerated like 1,000 miles an hour, right?
It seems like it's accelerated 1,000 miles an hour with all of the different strands of what's been talked about. You know, people suspected this, that and the other. And the whole thing has just, it's just rolled in so fast. It's really, really terrifying. It is, you know, and the fact that, I mean, I can't have a conversation with anyone that I know that don't want to talk to me, that don't want to listen to me.
That's very difficult, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I've got no one to speak to. They won't even listen. Won't even, I don't know, listen to a YouTube video and discuss it with me, you know, just to try and introduce people to these ideas. Just don't want to know.
I very rarely, in radio being radio, I very rarely get, recognised. You wouldn't get recognised too often. But a few weeks back, a chap came running up to me in near Liverpool Street and gave me a big hug. I was running, I was out jogging, and said he was a listener, and he was a bit emotional. And the reason he wanted to come over was not to say, oh, you know, you're brilliant and all this nonsense, was that he doesn't have anybody to speak to about these things. And the fact that there are, you know, places...
Give you a hug.
Give me a big man hug, And he said, that I don't have anybody to discuss these things with, but of an afternoon... I know that I'll hear from people today, from people like you, obviously, Melanie, and everybody else, people who see it as I see it. And it occurred to me then when I was running home, I thought how difficult it is to have an understanding of what's going on and yet be surrounded by people whom are obdurate or obstinate, stubborn, don't want to listen to it, to the point that they get belligerent sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, my next door neighbour today said, you know, that the lockdown's going to stop too soon. And, just to be surrounded by, you know, I know tonight there's going to be an awful lot of the pans banging outside. It's really, really heartbreaking because the way that I've kind of like seen it very, very recently is that if they had a plan... You could see that, you know, first of all, we should do this and then we need to assess it. And it's probably taken them by surprise how well it's gone down so far, you know, and then all of a sudden they have to kind of think of, you know, the next part of the plan probably before they assumed that they would have to.
That's a really good point.
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
I know, or really, rather, I instinctively feel that, you know, this hasn't happened by accident, for goodness sake.
No.
You know, it the plan is in place. It's been there probably a very long time, and there are steps that, you know, that they need to take the change through. And I just think it, this is probably taken by surprise that it's worked so well.
You made a very good point a moment ago as well. You said that the strands of this all accelerated together at the same time. I mean, you look at cashless society, that's perfect, that's working.
Yep.
You know, people informing on their friends and neighbours, well, that expedited really quickly. Yeah, you're absolutely right, yeah. I mean, David Icke always talked about the spider's web, you know, with the central goal in the middle and all the strands, you know, moving away from everything. It's all here now. I mean, you know, the digital health passport, Melanie, that we've been talking about this week, that's ready to go. And I think people will probably grab it with two hands because they will be told that, well, it'll make life much easier. The lockdown can ease a bit.
My neighbours certainly will. I mean, we don't even live in I'm in a village rather than a town. But just everyone's sold on this whole thing. And interesting, your previous caller, and the last time I spoke to you, I was quite a big focus on the transgender agenda, and I just think that people's heads have been so battered with kind of being encouraged into a chaotic kind of thinking, and normalizing the abnormal. You know, I always thought that was linked to this bigger thing, and my thinking hasn't changed. I really do, and I do think that they will march the robots out. I was driving last year through Milton Keynes, and something caught my eye. Actually, I wasn't driving, I was a passenger. And there was a robot dog at the side of the road.
No way, Melanie.
I got the shock of my life.
What was it like? Can you remember what it looked like? I mean, it might sound like a stupid question.
We just drove past, but yes, it was just like a dog. And it was pootling along at the pavement in a large industrial area. So there wasn't a lot of traffic. But, you know, I was on YouTube months and months ago and quite distressed to see someone had done a film on should robots have human rights?
Yes.
And I think that's where we're going with all of this. Like I said, you sort of like introduce people to the idea of the abnormal being normal, and then you insist on it, and then you do that, you know. Yes, it's all very sinister.
Well, I remember back in 2018, just before we wrap up today. I'm glad you got through, by the way. I really am. It's lovely to chat with you again, Melanie. I remember
you
back
too.
In
Thank you.
No, it really is. I remember back in 2018. I'm trying to think off the top of my head now. There was a robot called Sophia in Saudi Arabia. Do you remember this?
I think
they gave the robot rights equivalent to the rights of women there, which aren't very good anyway. But they gave they gave the robot rights maybe that women in Saudi Arabia don't have. So, you know, somebody might have listened to you and thought, oh, Melanie sounds lovely, but she's in cloud cuckoo land there. She's not in cloud cuckoo land. The idea of granting rights to robots is already in our consciousness. It's already in our world. It happened in Saudi Arabia. If I remember right, the robot actually addressed an assembly there and answered questions. Yeah. This is bizarre stuff, isn't it?
Well, they brought her out onto Good Morning TV, I think it was last year.
Did they?
They rolled her out, and she's sitting there, and they were bragging about how she had a discourse regarding international rights, and it was all linked to the UN.
And you know, do you know what makes me, again, I love the way we connect the dots. When I say we, I don't mean me, I don't do anything, but how the guests...
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. No, I'm not looking for compliments either. No, the guests and the listeners connect the dots. You've just connected a major dot for me now. There's been a major television series, hasn't there, based on the old film with Yul Brynner, Westworld.
West, absolutely.
Now, am I right in saying...
Watched it.
Did you watch it? Am I right in saying that the director of that is trying to get the audience to be sympathetic to the robots? You know, they want...
I've had the same thought.
Yeah. The robots are used in a theme park, and they get shot by the visitors in a Wild West situation. Then they get patched up and sent back out again because they're robots. But the robots have consciousness, apparently, and the viewer is being kind of almost invited to feel sorry for the robots. And I'm just wondering, is there an agenda to make people sympathetic to robots? And bloody hell, there you are.
I really do think that is the case, you know. You can't help thinking that now.
I tell you what, you know,
it's, yeah, but I just want to ask you one question, if you don't mind, Richie.
Not at all. Ask me anything.
Dean Henderson. Can't find him.
Oh, Dean. It's funny you said that. I sent Dean a Skype message the other day to ask him how he was and would he come back on. I know that his old email address, you might have corresponded with Dean. He's about 5 or 6 months ago, they kicked him off WordPress, didn't they? His website was kicked off.
Yes.
And he's had issues since then, yeah. But I'll find out. I will make it my business over the weekend and I'll get him back on the programme. Because I love Dean, yeah. Melanie, it's been a tonic. Wonderful. Thanks for coming on again up there in Newcastle. We'll talk anthropology again in the future, no doubt.
Brilliant. Yes, you take care. Thank you so much, Richie.
Not at all. Real pleasure. Look after yourself, Melanie, and enjoy the rest of the weekend. Fantastic calls today. Thanks to everybody who called in. I really appreciate that. It means everything to me that you do that. So to everybody, to Andy and to Julian and to Andrea in Oz, to Melanie there. We had another Andy, didn't we, as well. Thanks for calling in. Big thanks to Kevin Myers. I know there are one or two things Kevin said you won't agree with. That's all right. He's a fantastic guy. He's a great guy. He's a really interesting guy. Great writer, a great humanitarian, and I hope he does put a website together and start writing again. I told him I don't agree with his opinions on China and the virus, and I mentioned Fauci, of course, and all of that. That's what we do, you see. We talk to people we disagree with, and we enjoy them, because ultimately, most of us can see what's happening. We might see what is happening, and we might think that we might use a different mathematical equation to understand it. And Kevin Myers knows that the world is going to shit. But he sees the chain of events leading up to it in a different light than maybe I would. But it's important that we talk to people who see the world differently than we do. I know some of you melt down. I made the point, you know. I'll raise your criticisms of China and I will see them with the United States, Israel, the UK, France and so on. Listen, have a great weekend. I'll talk to you on Sunday. I've gone over, so I'm going to chop the programme up into three parts for YouTube. I will not be posting the entire programme on YouTube. Not today. I'll put three parts on. I'll put the news roundup, the phone-in show and Kevin's interview. But the programme, unedited, will be on Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes and all the rest of it. In around about a half an hour's time. Look after yourselves. Look after yourselves. Look after the people living next door to you. Got to start caring about people again. I love you. I'll see you on Sunday. Bye now.